Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Warfare has changed a lot over the decades, from stones and slings to arrows and bronze and iron and steel, of course gunpowder and shot and horses, and of course tanks. And military historian Matthew Wright has collated a bit about how New Zealand's military has changed over the decades in a new book. It's called Those Who Have the Courage. It brings together the story of how New Zealand's mounted and armoured forces developed throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. I spoke to Matthew earlier today and began by asking about whether writing this book had crystallised for him just how dramatically warfare had evolved over the centuries.
I mean, warfare has always been a product of technology. I mean, that's, you know, even, you know, back in hunter-gatherer days, 150,000, 200,000 years ago, you know, they had to develop the technology to build a club and then they had to figure out how to use it. So it's no different with this story that, you know, you go from the 19th century, which was, I mean, a very, very revolutionary time for technology. There was a lot being developed. And for various reasons, a lot of it was military, and it transformed the battlefield. And a lot of the story that I've got in the book here is a reflection of the broader story, which was, how do you cope with that? How do you develop new strategies for dealing with the new technology? How does that absorb into existing methods? And finally, how do you pay for it?
Let's talk a bit about the early days, the mounted forces, the days of the cavalry. What was the broad sort of function of cavalry in Aotearoa in the sort of mid to late 19th century?
Well, they were brought in primarily, raised for colonial self-defence, in effect. The very first forces ever raised in New Zealand in 1845 was actually a small cavalry troop. And the horse was provided mobility, which, of course, is a key theme of the whole story throughout for the mounted and armoured forces. But there was also a very great social framework around them because, you know, at the time the society was going through social militarism, which was the social acceptability of the trappings of being military. So, you know, the heroism on the battlefield was uplifted. And this was a very much across the whole British Empire and into its colonies. And so what I found was that this was reflected in the way that the cavalry forces were, first of all, drawn from the settlers, and the way that they were then treated by the settlers and viewed themselves. You know, there was very, very much thinking that they were moving along in cavalry lines, but in fact the necessary tactics, the necessary work that they had to do was a little bit different from that.
Cavalry was actually relevant in New Zealand for quite some time, wasn't it? I note from the book that there was a mounted brigade at Gallipoli, and they had an absolutely torrid time, didn't they?
Well, they did. By this stage, the evolution of tactics had changed the entire role, even the name of these forces. They were mounted rifles, and the idea was that they would train up as, in effect, foot soldiers, but they would gain mobility by being on horses. So the idea was that you'd leap on the horse, gallop across the battlefield or to a part of the battlefield where you were needed, dismount, and then go forward to fight on foot. So they got into Gallipoli because when the Anzac forces landed on Gallipoli, the mounted brigade was left behind in Egypt. And they were a bit miffed at this, but their commanding officer, Brigadier General Andrew Russell, was able to organise getting them into Gallipoli on foot. And at that point, they were So they fought on foot for the next 8 months or so of the Gallipoli campaign, and they were absolutely shot to pieces. The casualty rate was absolutely enormous. I was able to find figures giving somewhere actual recorded figures. It's an issue with Gallipoli that documentation is a bit short when you get down to that detail. But I found the very specific figures showing that they had anything up to 93, 94% casualty rate across that period, which wow. is simply enormous.
Massive, yeah. Are there reasons for that?
Yes. The average casualty rate across the whole of Gallipoli, and there's been a lot of work done by New Zealand and military historians on this in the past 5, 6 years, including by me, the average rate was about 60%, which in general was about average for the whole of First World War trench warfare. That was about where it stood. And, I mean, you know, it sounds casual to say, oh, it was 60%. Yeah. That was absolutely horrific.
That's horrifying. Yeah, that is just astonishing. What a brutal war it was, yeah.
Yeah, but then you got the mounted force fighting on foot. They were at around 93, 94%. And so I looked into what happened, and there are a couple of reasons for it, but the primary one was that the size of an equivalent mounted force was only three quarters that of an infantry force, because some of the men had to be left back to tend the horses. So they fought at about three quarters scale, but they were being given tasks that a larger infantry force would normally do. And so, of course, but they went out and did them anyway. The courage, the bravery, the absolute, you know, integrity that went on was tremendous, and they really suffered for it in that sense. It was quite a phenomenal story.
When do we begin to embrace the tank, and how massive a development was the tank in changing the face of warfare, I suppose?
Yeah, well, I mean, mechanisation, motorisation, mechanisation were two words not quite interchangeable. Huge, huge development emerged in the First World War. I've been able to prove for the first time that New Zealand's involvement in tank warfare started in the First World War in a very real and fiscally draining way, because our government was paying additional sums to our guys that happened to be transferred across to the British Tank Corps. So it was a drain on the New Zealand funds. So by, you know, practical measure, that you know, that's the start of our tank story. The transformation of our own armed force to tanks didn't occur till late 1930s and into the Second World War. Mainly, again, financial. The main issue was financial. There just wasn't a lot of money about. This was true for just about everyone, of course. All the major powers were having issues finding money for the military in the 1920s and 30s. But New Zealand had never had very high spending, and it was no different into the 30s. So the transformation to armour was about on par with Britain and other countries, a little bit slower, gained pace in the Second World War because they had to. It became necessary. You had to have tanks with you. And after very considerable argument within army circles, which the expeditionary force commander essentially pushed, this was Major General Bernard Freiburg, after a fairly massive argument that he broadly pushed, they got an armoured brigade, which then fought with great distinction in Italy. Other armour was set up here in New Zealand, and I dug right into a whole pile of documents. There's many, many files sitting in Archives New Zealand that I looked through. There was no question about the extent to which New Zealand forces looked into the whole of that technology. They looked into ways that they could extend the tactics. They looked into how everything worked. They're right up there with the rest of the world in doing that.
Our tanks, I think our armoured corps, I think I'm right in saying this, was deployed to the Pacific in 1943, there or thereabouts. And I think your grandfather was actually involved with an infantry battalion tasked with taking Nisan Island. Is that right?
Yeah. That was just a slight personal aside. My grandfather served with 15 battalion, which did the commando raid on Nisan Island, and they subsequently took it in early 1944. And they were accompanied by a small tank force, which had been essentially customised in New Zealand for jungle warfare. And again, I dug through all the documentation, and they were specifically built, developed up and built here with a different gun that was optimised for that jungle work. So that was Nisan Island. And that was our only deployment of tanks, in fact, in the Pacific during the Second World War.
Yeah. There are many anecdotes about tanks in this book. Indeed, I think tanks fought in the Vietnam War as well, and the book has some previously unpublished photographs of them. My question, though, is did you get into the Bob Semple tank at all, Matthew?
Yes, I did. There's a lot of mythology about that tank, which was, you know, Ministry of Works put an armoured box on top of a bulldozer, and they were going to use that as a tank. The army took one look at it, said, well, you can't have a turret on it because it's top heavy. It was no good overland. You couldn't change gear while it was moving. And a whole pile of other things were wrong with it. So, you know, the question is, well, was this just done for morale purposes? Mm. I mean, why did they do it? And one of the discoveries that I made was that, well, it could have been used on a paved road in, say, Auckland as a kind of mobile pillbox. And you've got to remember that the Japanese were expected to attack mainly with aircraft and infantry. They didn't have heavy tanks. They would have been unlikely to have anything too heavy land in New Zealand if they were going to do it at all, which incidentally there's no particular evidence proving that. But so it might have been useful as a pillbox, but essentially it was more for morale purpose than anything else.
Number 8 wire mentality. Great stuff.
Yeah.
It's fascinating stuff. Whereabouts can people get copies of this book, please?
Well, literally in all good bookshops. It's right through all the main chains. It's being sold nationally across New Zealand. And go and check it out.
Great stuff. It's called Those Who Have the Courage. Matthew Wright is the author. And Matthew, thanks so much for your time this evening.
Thank you.
And that was Matthew Wright.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.